From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
Hey, Jason.
Amazing to finally connect.
This guy I'm talking to, his name is Neil Goyle, and we have been trying to connect for years. But it wasn't possible until now because Neil had been in federal prison. Today, he's out.
How's it been? How's life?
Wow. You know, I try to put into words how it feels to be out, you know, after a long time. I mean, I was away for almost 4 years. And when you come out, you have this view of the way you think the world's going to be. And a lot of it, no matter how much we read or keep up to date on what's going on in the world outside, so much is different than what you had expected. So much is different than when I first came in. And so literally every step I take, every interaction I have, I find like this new breath of fresh air. It's like a new learning opportunity or something I wasn't expecting. But everything in and of itself feels like a complete blessing. And I feel extremely fortunate given the position that I'm in.
Right. So let's talk about that position he's in. Here was the headline from the Chicago Tribune, July 2nd, 2015. 6 years in prison for hedge funder in Ponzi scheme. It ran with a photo of Neil dressed in a gray suit and purple tie as he was entering the courtroom that day. His wife was with him and she looked exhausted. The lead of the story read like this, quote, "The former head of a Chicago investment firm tearfully apologized to his victims, sobbing as he addressed family members he'd scammed before he was sentenced Thursday to 6 years in prison for stealing more than $9 million in a Ponzi scheme," end quote. Now, how am I connected with Neil? Because he wrote me a letter from prison. I actually get quite a lot of letters from prison. It's a thing that happens to journalists. Prisoners, you know, they have a lot of time to sit around and read magazines, and then they write letters. And the letters are usually handwritten and often bizarre. Oh, I have stories about weird conspiracy theories that have been sent to me, or people pleading their innocence, or just looking for a pen pal, I think. I generally ignore them. But Neil's letter was different. It arrived at my office in January of 2018, and it was professional and printed. It came in a large manila envelope, along with materials about his crime and the coverage of it. And he acknowledged up front that he had done wrong, and he had done a lot of soul searching in prison and wanted us to publish a piece by him that warned people away from the terrible path that he'd chosen. He wrote this, quote, "When I launched my hedge fund at age 24, I was ambitious and hungry. While I had the talent for investing, my mismanagement of failures led me down a dark path of dishonesty. I placed my ego above truth, prioritized my greed, compromised the morals I grew up with, and sacrificed the security of those I loved," end quote. And this, I have not seen a lot of this coming out of prison. So I responded to Neil, and we were able to communicate over this email system for inmates called CoreLinks. And I told him I wasn't all that interested in just publishing something he'd written, but that I'd like to talk with him and share the conversation on Problem Solvers. And he agreed, and then we spent nearly 2 years trying to get the prison system to approve the interview, which they never did. But this past fall, Neil finished serving his sentence and was released. So he emailed me the normal way, and we agreed to finally get on the phone. And when we did, Neil was just as upfront about his mistakes as he was in his emails.
"I continued to pour one dishonesty on top of another lie, on top of another lie. And this created a snowballing problem that I felt like I was slowly losing control of."
So here's what we're going to do on this episode of Problem Solvers. We're going to hear from Neil, which is to say we're going to hear from a man who made a massive mistake, who was punished for it, and who is now picking up the pieces. I'll be honest, I was a little hesitant to do this at first because I didn't want this show to be a tool by which a convicted criminal can rehabilitate their reputation. But after talking with Neil, I honestly don't think that's what this is. I mean, sure, he wants people to know that he's a changed man, which is understandable. And for what it's worth, the justice system considers him a free man now, so who am I to say otherwise? But mostly, I'm comfortable giving Neil this platform because he speaks in a way that we so rarely hear, but that we really should hear more of. He's a man who talks very openly about his mistakes and the personal flaws he's working through. He has done a lot of thinking about how somebody goes wrong and the amount of work that they have to do on themselves to get right. So coming up, it is Neil and the long journey of self-reflection and self-improvement right after this. What do you have in your bathroom? Okay, maybe that sounds like a weird question, but I mean, you know, the stuff in your bathroom is the stuff you put on your body. And do you know what's in that stuff? It could be not great. But if you have native deodorant in your bathroom like I do, then you know exactly what's in there. Coconut oil, shea butter, stuff you find in nature, and it's never been tested on animals. Native has a range of great scents. The one in my bathroom right now is coconut and vanilla, which is their most popular scent. But there's also lavender and rose and cucumber and mint and all the stuff that, let's be frank about it, you'll be very happy to put on your armpits. And thanks to Native, it is super easy to get a hold of this great product. You can get 20% off your first purchase, and all you have to do is go to nativedeodorant.com and use the promo code Problem Solvers during checkout. Native offers free returns and exchanges in the USA, so there's really no risk. Again, for 20% off your first purchase, go to nativedeodorant.com and use the promo code Problem Solvers. And now, our next sponsor. I am a Dollar Shave Club member, and that's not just because they bought an ad on Problem Solvers. I mean, I have literally been using this company for years. And I'll be honest, at first I signed up just because of the price. I liked that this company was upending the expensive razor industry. But I stuck around because their stuff is genuinely high quality and they keep expanding their offerings. They also now have everything you need to shower, shave, style your hair, brush your teeth, and yes, even wipe your butt. And with their subscription service, your bathroom never runs out of the stuff you need. And you don't have to just take my word for it, because right now you can put the quality of Dollar Shave Club's products to the test yourself. Their Ultimate Shave Starter Set has basically everything you need for an amazing shave. The Executive Razor, Shave Butter, Prep Scrub, and Post Shave Do. Try it just for $5. After that, the restock box ships regular size products at regular prices. So get your Ultimate Starter Set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/problem solvers. That's dollarshaveclub.com/problem solvers. All right, we're back. As you will hear, Neil speaks like a guy who has spent a lot of time thinking about what he has to say. He is a deliberate speaker, a thorough speaker, and as we talked, I got the feeling that Neil just wanted to make sure that he said everything he possibly could say. So I wanted to start with the basics. Who is Neil Goyle? Where did he come from? And what led him to make this fateful decision? And here's what he said.
You know, I grew up in a really humble family. Family of physicians. We were a family of overachievers. I was first generation here in the United States. My parents were immigrants from India. And we were brought up with pretty much every educational opportunity available. We were students that it was me and four of my siblings. I was the oldest of five. And we all did really well in school. We all performed. We all held ourselves to a high standard. And we were excited about kind of what our prospects for a career are, because, you know, our parents provided us those opportunities to explore. And so I wanted to pursue, you know, success a different way. My family was a family of physicians. I wanted to kind of carve my own path to success. I wanted to stand out from the pack and show that, you know, there are other ways to achieve that success. And so from an early age, I fell in love with the stock market. Age 17, 18 years old, I expressed to my parents the interest that I had in the stock market. And just like the wonderful parents that they are, they supported my vision. They enrolled me in some courses and educational programs that helped me kind of get my feet wet. And it was pretty much at that juncture where I completely fell in love with everything that had to do with the financial markets. It's all I ever wanted to do for my life. And I had made that decision by the time I was 18 years old. And so as I went through college and law school, I went to college at Indiana University, studied finance over there, and I went to law school in San Diego. And over that 7-year period, I continued to trade. I had many experiences where I lost money, many experiences where I earned a profit. All it did over that 7-year period was solidify that the stock market was one giant puzzle that everyone was trying to solve, yet no one could do it. And for me, that was a thrilling experience, the opportunity to be able to test your strategies out and be proven remarkably right or remarkably wrong, and how I felt like I was the one that I could, you know, devise some kind of strategy that would allow me to figure it out. And it was in my third year of law school where I decided to formalize that passion and formalize my talent by launching my own hedge fund. I was 23 years old, I was excited, I was eager, and I wanted to be able to take my strategy and my experience and translate that into a firm and launch my own fund. And so I did exactly that. I started raising capital when I was 23 years old, and for a hedge fund from kind of a friends and family network. And this was the happiest day in my life. It was a moment that I remember picture perfectly to this day, the day I opened my fund, because everything I had done until that point was now being formalized into a structure which would guide the trajectory of my career. I knew that this was a turning point in my career where I'm beginning this on-ramp, and I was so incredibly excited about it. And so when I got started, I was doing much of what I was doing before. Again, just taking a little bit of larger lump sum of money and investing in the stock market. And for the first couple of years, everything was going really well. I was excited about what was happening. I was performing and, again, truly living out my dream. And I was effectively bootstrapped. I had no track record. I had no formal professional experience in terms of actually running other people's money. But at the same time, I found that this was something that I loved more and more each day as it went on. It was within the first couple of years, I encountered this kind of climactic point where, or should I say a fork in the road. I had my very first quarterly trading loss. And then that was when I was at the helm of other people's money. I had had plenty of other losing quarters in my 7-8 years prior. But this was the first time that it happened when I was in the driver's seat of someone else's money. And the thought process that ran through my mind at that point was very focused on what this would mean for my career, being so young, you know, being so early in the career. I told myself, wait, how can you possibly produce a loss now? You are too early. You have no track record yet. How poorly does this reflect upon you in terms of, you know, what you're capable of achieving? And how will this affect your ability to raise capital in the future? I continue to ask these thoughts to myself. And as I stared at that first quarterly loss, and it was like, it felt like an ultimate failure. For me, historically, I'm very much of an all or nothing type of personality in terms of if I get a 99%, if I was shy of that 100% or shy of a certain goal that I wanted to achieve, I still looked at that goal as failure. I didn't look at it as, hey, you did great and we can do better next time. I looked at just anything shy of what I wanted to achieve as total failure. And that's how I viewed this moment. And so it was at that moment I made the absolute worst decision of my life. I chose to, you know, manipulate the results that I reported to investors. And instead of reporting a minor loss, which was a really, really minor loss, I chose to report a profit. And that ended up being one of the worst decision I've made in my entire life, because not only at that moment did I choose to lie and choose to cover something up and cover up my missteps, but I also basically took all of those really humble, honest, ethical family values that I had been raised with and effectively threw them out the window. And as a result, I started this snowball of losses and snowball of misrepresentation that as I continued to try to work back those losses, as I tried to earn back those losses in the stock market in following quarters, the reality was that wasn't happening. And so the misrepresentation that I made to investors continued to snowball as well.
See, I told you he speaks with thoroughness. The crime went on for about 5 years. And of course, the stakes got higher and higher as it went along, and his just terrible decisions kept compounding.
I think the worst thing about what I did, and the part that really I still think about every single day, is if I had dug this problem and dug myself into a hole that I didn't want to admit and that I didn't want to disclose, then why did I continue to raise more capital as time went on? And so that's the part that I had to really think about. I had to really dig down deep and saying, you know, this wasn't just a dishonesty. This wasn't just a you know, covering up and misrepresentation on paper to investors, but I continued to raise capital on returns that weren't real. And even though I believed at that moment, erroneously believed that more capital would mean more money I could put in the stock market, which could then potentially work to generate a positive return eventually, that proved to be a completely delusional belief in terms of thinking realistically. I had completely lost sight of what was at stake here. And what started as a small loss, the first loss that I ever covered up was an $8,000 cover up, literally $8,000. And my own ego and desire for notoriety and lack of humility and sense of entitlement allowed me to cover $8,000 up to snowball into $10 million over 5 years. So, for me, that's where, how could I let such a small problem that was initially a small problem snowball so far out of control to the point where I really thought about nobody else other than myself?
As I listened to Neil talk about the beginnings of all this, I got to thinking, well, it was this thing that I said in the intro of this episode about how rare it is to hear someone report their own misdeeds and to report them so plainly, I mean, he talks about this with such a matter of factness, just so straightforward. And so I pointed that out to him. And you also don't talk about it with exasperation. You don't talk about it with disbelief. You just talk about it. How long did it take to get there?
I think when 2014, happened, when, I got the call from the Securities Exchange Commission and basically everything unraveled from there. As chaotic as a time that was in my life, for me, my family, for the investors, for everyone that had a stake somehow, there was also a feeling of, thank goodness this is over. I had dug myself into so big of a hole that I myself just felt at a loss as to what to do next, how to get out of this. And so the fact that this ended when it did, that I received that call when it did, I very quickly realized how much of a blessing that really was. That instead of creating this prolonged problem where I kept doing the same thing over and over and over, expecting a different result, that cycle was over. And that as painful as it would be, and knowing the fact that I would be going away because of it, the reality was that I wouldn't be able to cause this strife for anyone anymore. And to me, that was a very liberating feeling. I felt like I had lived my life so dishonestly that I was ready to come to a point of clarity in my life. On one hand, I had such a beautiful family. I'm a husband. I have three beautiful boys. And that part of my life was incredible. And then at the same time, I had this lie that I was living at work in my professional career. And, having the opportunity to reevaluate all the important things in my life as soon as I walked in and realized what are the things that happened along the way, that's something that I believe I was ready for from the day I walked in. Now, in terms of being able to openly talk about it, yeah, that was difficult. It took some time because I had lived this life of secrecy for so long, it's tough to open up about it after that. It's really hard. But at the same time, now that everything had been exposed, everything was out in the open, in a way that allowed me to also be open as well and openly talk about it. So, when I was in, that was uncustomary. I openly talked about my offense. I openly talked about the ways I behaved and how my own thinking patterns and my own self-talk and my own logic was so flawed, and I became more comfortable talking about it. And that, again, that was uncommon in prison, because in prison, people prefer not to talk about their offenses. They prefer to kind of live still in the shell. Some do it from a safety perspective. Others do it because they haven't come to terms with their own guilt. And for me, I had been living this life of secrecy for long enough to the point where I wanted to do the polar opposite. I just wanted to live transparently. And no matter how bad it sounds for describing the actions that I engaged in, that didn't matter to me, because for me, transparency kind of became a priority.
When you went to prison, did you think of yourself as a project? I could imagine, and I've never been in anything near your situation, so I'm really just imagining here, but I'll put it to you and you tell me what's real. That you've done this thing and it was wrong, and now you're suffering the consequences of it, and you look at yourself and you're like, well, something inside of me needs fixing, because something inside of me led me to those decisions. I mean, there's a logical chronology of the decisions and how a small error leads to a larger error and all that, but there was there was an original moment where you could have reported the $8,000 loss or not, and you chose not to. Sure. And that means something inside of you had driven yourself. So I'm wondering how you sat there, and if it was an immediate instinct or if it took time for you to get there, how you started to kind of evaluate yourself and what you needed to do for yourself.
When I walked into prison, I thought I had been humbled by the experience, right? Through the indictment and through the various set of events that happened before I went in, I thought I had been humbled by this whole process. But I realized when I walked in how much more I needed to ground myself than I already was. I still had lacked humility in so many facets of my life.
Now, how did you identify that?
A lot of that came through getting feedback from others. One of the things that I don't think I did well throughout my life was take feedback from others. You know, I believed, at least in my early adulthood, had grew to believe that, you know, I knew the answer, that I could solve anything, that I didn't really need to ask for help, that I tried to find a flaw in me and I just couldn't find it, right? And that was driven by kind of this growing ego. And so when I came in, I had welcomed feedback from people that were important to me and from others, and realized from them, from how much work I needed to do in my own personal life.
What does it mean to welcome feedback from people? Did you tell me things about myself? What does that mean?
So it came through, you know, when you're in prison and you feel like you wronged certain people, and I felt an overwhelming sense of remorse and was extremely apologetic for my actions. But the response I received when I wrote, let's say, wrote an apology letter to someone, and they respond back stating that there's a lack of genuineness in your apology. And I didn't understand what that meant. I didn't understand that I wasn't appearing genuine. Because for me, I knew how I felt. I knew that I wanted to make it up to those I affected. I knew that I had a sense of redemption that I wanted to achieve. But when I got feedback, I realized that it wasn't just during the period of my crime that caused problem, but I had really been, even people who didn't know anything about my crime had already realized that I was just living with this ballooning sense of ego. And so that was something that was eye-opening for me, that it wasn't just about the crime, but it was actually the way I was carrying my life. It was not specific to my actions day in and day out at the office. Like I had grown so good at compartmentalizing my crime in my own mind and saying, hey, the bad is happening here at the office. I have this problem that I'm neck deep in, I can't get out of, right? And then somehow I was able to flip that switch off for the rest of my personal life. And that was just kind of this subconscious compartmentalization that I started to do over time, creating kind of this double life mentality. But at the same time, my ego was ballooning on both sides of the equation. My ego was ballooning at work, and my ego was ballooning in my personal life. And so when you hear from people that you care about and that still are standing by you, even despite your indiscretions, then you learn things from them that they wanted to tell you for a long time, that, but they just didn't have the opportunity to do so, or didn't feel that I was open to that feedback. And so by virtue of reaching out to people that I cared about, it kind of opened that opportunity to have a more open dialogue than ever before. It gave me the opportunity to connect and learn about what it is about my actions that bothered them most. And I feel like I'm still learning that every day, even today. The ripple effect of my actions, this is not something that just goes away just by virtue of my sentence being complete. This is something that my actions create a ripple effect that, you know, what, for instance, for an investor who invested capital with me, that was part of their livelihood. That was part of their retirement plan. That was part of their long-term goals. And I played a role in negatively affecting that. And so those ripple effects will be felt for a long time to come. And I'm extremely aware of that. When I would go to bed every night, I'd be laying on my top bunk about 3 feet from the ceiling, and I would kiss the photos of my wife and children goodnight. And when I'd close my eyes, the last thing I would still see, even after I have that moment with them, was the investors, the faces of the individual investors that were affected by my crime. And that is something that at first was haunting, that I knew I had wronged these people. And I knew I had created a period of strife in their lives that are different in different ways. But over time, those faces became motivators. They became a motivator for me to want to make a change and to actually work down a path of redemption and make amends with those individuals. And I know there's a chance that that desire for amends may never be the case for me. I understand that. I'm highly aware that I may never earn that forgiveness. But at the same time, it's a motivator for me because I do want to make it up to them. That is my desire. And, you know, that is part of my long-term plan in terms of forging down a path to redemption. I do believe I owe something to them, I owe something in a huge way. And it's not just about the financial restitution that I owe. There's an emotional restitution. There's a social restitution. There's a psychological restitution. There's so much ways that a debt needs to be paid back. And that's what ultimately drives me.
You're receiving this feedback from people. You're seeing how other people saw you, which in turn is helping you identify some of your own problems. Like, what did you actively, tangibly do? Were you talking to counselors in prison? Were you just thinking a lot? Were you writing your thoughts? What were you doing there that helped you process all this?
To start out, the first place I started when I walked in was I just started writing. It was just a kind of being able to gather my thoughts, organize them on paper, and truly basically materialize what was going on in my mind. And at first, it was kind of a mess. I was all over the place in terms of my writing. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that I myself was just releasing a lot of this information out of my mind for the first time. And it was an uncomfortable process. There were a couple other projects that I did.
Wait. Before you move on to that, I'm just curious. Can you unpack it was a comfortable process for me? What were you discovering and how did you get through that discomfort?
So as I continue to kind of unpack what was in my mind, I realized that there were numerous points in my thinking patterns that had become so incredibly flawed. The question is, and what the question I continued to ask myself was, yes, okay, you made your first wrong choice. But what was it in your mind that continued to lead to this nonstop cycle of bad decisions over the next 5 years? This wasn't just a one-off crime. This was a continued pattern behavior that had developed over time where it was the ability to pack one dishonesty on top of another and do so without any end in sight. And for me, as I continued to unpack what that meant, and realized that I had become living in a true sense of entitlement in more ways than I had originally seen, that was very uncomfortable for me, almost nauseating. And part of that was comparing it to the way I was raised. I was raised by extremely humble people and people that don't want that recognition and people that are not chasing money and people that believe that hard work and doing things the right way without shortcuts is the only way. And on the flip side, as I'm writing, I'm realizing that I had literally evolved into someone who was doing exactly the opposite of the way he was raised. That I had become greedy. I had become a person that took shortcuts instead of doing things the right way. I had become dishonest instead of honest. I had become entitled instead of humble. And I had effectively become a manipulator by virtue of knowing that I'm negatively affecting other people with the intent to personally benefit me. And as I write that for the first time, it's nauseating. Before you realize, oh, I did something really wrong, and yes, everything about what I did was bad. But when you realize the thinking patterns and the personality traits that had evolved over time to get you to that point, you realize that this was something that is so much deeper than what initially met the surface when I first walked in. And so as I continued to write that, that's where I felt, I guess I kept writing more and more and more. Because writing is what helped me gather my thoughts. I was not a speaker. I was in terms of being able to openly speak transparently. It wasn't until the first few months I joined a program called Toastmasters. It's an international public speaking program with chapters all over the world. And they had a chapter at Lompoc prison camp. And when I joined, I had never done public speaking in my life, but a friend encouraged me to join. And it was that first instance where you're standing on stage in front of about 35 other people, all other inmates, and you're supposed to give an icebreaker about who you are, what you're about, where you come from, and a little bit about your story. And that was the first opportunity where now I'm speaking about my past in front of people that I don't know. And, you know, it was nerve-wracking, but as time went on, I realized that this is something that I wanted to do. I wasn't good at it, but I wanted to do it because I've found this to be an outlet for me to openly speak about my crime and openly speak about the ways my mindset and thinking patterns were flawed.
What's important about both of these things, writing and speaking, is that in both cases, what you're doing is you're putting form to thought, which is an important thing to do, especially if you're trying to understand your own thoughts. You have to take them out of your head in some way so that you can them. And that means you actually have to articulate them. And articulating ideas to somebody else, whether it's people on an audience or just an imagined audience, if you're just writing something down for nobody, it forces you to make ideas solid, which is a very hard thing to do if they're just stuck in your head.
Yeah, you know, and quite frankly, you're exactly right. Because when I realized the feedback I received from that group, obviously, you know, we're in a very forgiving format. Every other person sitting in that room had also made certain life choices that landed them in that exact position. So it was a very forgiving audience at the same time. But from the perspective of creating valuable thought process or actually being able to create a form in which you're translating what you wrote into the way you speak, now you're actually trying to deliver something that's engaging that the audience can learn from. And that was something that took time. Again, I was in the program for a year and a half, and I continued to work to get better as far as conveying my thoughts. Towards the end of the program, though, you know, I realized something, that as great as it was a feeling to be able to speak openly about my past and the things that I've learned along the way, who was this really serving? And at the end of the day, it was still only serving myself. Like it was helping me learn about the thinking patterns and everything that went wrong and helping me conceptualize and gather my thoughts. But at the same time, it was really only benefiting me. And so that's kind of where I took a second step when I was in prison to do something a little bit more impactful. I went to a staff counselor in the prison and I said, I want to be able to start an organization that utilizes these same stories. Right now, we speak so openly about our backgrounds and all the things that we did wrong, but why can't we do that in front of youth groups and high schools and junior highs and college programs and probationary programs, juvenile centers, to be able to share our stories with at-risk youth or young professionals or high schoolers so they don't end up down that same path of poor choices like we did? And me and a great friend of mine, we started this program together and we pitched it to the warden of the prison, and the program was called IMPACT, Inmates Mentoring Peers Against Criminal Thinking. And it was during that program where we were blessed by the prison to be able to go out into the community and actually publicly speak in front of high schoolers. For me, I wanted to pursue this kind of path to redemption where I could help other people not end up in the same place that I did, or help them avoid the same path of choices that I did. And so instead of just me speaking about it to myself or in front of an audience that's already in prison, I wanted to be able to do something that actually can help people that are out there right now. And that's exactly what we did.
What was that like the very first time you did it? You've created this thing, you've practiced quite a lot inside the prison. Now, for the first time since going to prison, I suppose, you are walking out of it in front of a bunch of high schoolers. And you're going to talk about how much you screwed up. That you probably thought you were prepared for that. Were you prepared for that?
You know, Jason, one of the things that I struggled with most in my adulthood was being very conscious of what my image was. I was overconscious. I was so paranoid with what everybody else was thinking. I was so concerned about my image. I really wanted to hold myself in like the most positive possible light. And when you get up in front of a stage or in front of an audience of what I call effectively normal people, right? Just everyday people. And you're talking about all the ways you messed up and all the ways that you betrayed people that you cared about, or all the ways that you broke trust that society may have had in you, you realize that it's a scary process. I remember that first presentation we ever did, it was our team members. I had assembled a team of 11 impact members and our staff counselor. And those 11 members, even though we had rehearsed and prepared for it, this was the first time we were doing a live presentation in front of an audience that was not in prison. And every single one of the members, including myself, was sick to their stomach, because it was not just about the public speaking element, but it was about the fact that we're exposing every single thing we did wrong. You know, in society, we have a tendency to focus on wanting to highlight all of the ways we did something well. We want to highlight our successes. And I know I was an extreme version of that. But in this situation, we were doing exactly the opposite. And that was a challenging thing. But at the end of that first presentation, we learned something. First of all, the entire audience connected with us. The entire audience felt what we were feeling. On that first day, out of the 11 members that presented, 4 of the members ended up breaking down in tears on that stage. I was one of them. And it was a feeling of, we lived such a long part of our life worrying about what other people are thinking. And here we're intentionally making an effort to share all the negative things about ourselves. And it was an empowering feeling. It was an incredible feeling. And the feedback we received was incredible as well. We ended up, the program took off, where we were presenting 3 to 5 times per month to various high schools and junior highs and even college criminal justice programs. And it was a feeling that as each presentation went on, we got this feeling of, wow, it's okay to discuss our flaws. It's okay to disclose our flaws. In fact, the more we disclose our flaws, the more receptive people are to hearing more about us. That's where I learned that. That's where I learned, wow, what we say in the exposure of our own flaws can actually help an individual become more honest with themselves. When we received feedback from, you know, various high schoolers, and Ms. Hawkins, the staff counselor, who was our facilitator for the program, she would receive feedback forms in the mail. And students would write about how this program impacted their lives in a positive way, whether it helped them, you know, jump out of a gang or you know, not cheat on that test or even avoid the thought of suicide. All of these things were kind of things we heard in feedback forms from these children. We realized, wow, not only are we learning how to speak about our crime and be open about our crime, but it's actually making an impact on children that are in challenged situations.
This is not something that people need to learn by going to prison and then speaking to high schoolers, but it is something that I think everybody needs to learn in some form or another. And I've had similar experiences, different context, obviously, but for example, I can remember speaking, I was sitting on some panel in front of a group of college students a couple of years ago, and talking, as I very often do, about various mistakes that I've made and so on. And afterwards, one of the students came up to me and thanked me for the vulnerability and for sharing not just the great things, but the bad things. And she said that was, you know, that was really helpful and also something that she doesn't hear very often. And I told her, I said, you know, it actually isn't hard to do that once you realize that people like it.
Sure.
And people actually get a lot of value out of you being vulnerable. And it's not a scary thing. And in fact, I was like, I'm glad it was valuable for you. But for me, it was very easy to do because I knew exactly what I was doing. I know that it's useful and that people want to hear it. And that encourages me to do it more. And if you do the same thing, I told her, other people will thank you. That's quite in contrast to, I think, what, like you said, people's instinct is about how they present themselves, which is to present only the good. And also what we just generally see around us, which is oftentimes people only presenting the good of themselves.
Sure. I mean, I could not agree more. You know, in terms of wanting to kind of showcase those successes, again, doing the opposite is a difficult feeling. And it's being truly vulnerable. And when you hear responses from people appreciating that vulnerability, it makes you want to do it again. It makes you want to dig deeper, dig further, and expose more about yourself. You know, when we started this program, we did so with the mentality, we want to make a difference. We want to help this community in some way. And we had no idea that we'd actually be helping ourselves so much, just as much as we may have been helping those kids. We realized how much we learned about ourselves and how much of a shell we had been living under. And we were truly rewarded by that vulnerability. You know, we ended up speaking to over 2,500 kids in 3 years. And, you know, for me, that's something that an experience that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life. I never want anything from it. We weren't rewarded in any way for it. All we got was a feeling that at the end of a presentation, we felt like we did something good that day, that we had done so many wrong things in our life. But for that day, we felt like we really did make a positive impact on our community in some way. And for me, that was a feeling that was priceless. That was a feeling that took away that frozen feeling where you're in prison and you want to make amends and you want to forge down a path to redemption and you want to do positive things to make contributions to your community, but you can't because you're in prison. And this took away that feeling. This took away that feeling of being frozen or in a glass cage.
Did there come a point when you were in prison where you felt like the project that you came into prison for, which was fixing yourself? I mean, obviously there's fixing the harm that you did to others that you've talked about, and that's a harder thing to fix, obviously. But did there come a point where you felt like I've made what feels like a turnaround? Was there some moment of recognition or some feeling of transformation, or how did that all process for you?
I can't say that there was one tipping point that where I woke up one day and said, oh, I'm a changed man. You know, honestly, I feel like that change is still happening right now. I feel like every day I'm trying to make more progress than I was the previous day. I don't think it's ever going to be done. I don't think there's an end point to that. So in terms of, you know, feeling like, hey, when did I make that turn? I felt like that was a very gradual thing that happened over the course of my incarceration. And I feel like it's still happening to this very day. I feel like I'm still learning new things about ways I need to check myself in terms of my own humility. I mean, in terms of the way I view things or my perspective towards life in general. And I feel like I'm learning something new every single day, and it's helping me. And I think it's only when one is truly open to actively looking for those flaws in their own mindset is when that change can happen. I am every single day, I'm thinking about, what is it about my current pattern, thinking pattern right now that is flawed? What is it about what I'm doing right now that could be detrimental in some way? What is it that I'm not seeing that I should be seeing? And those are questions I feel like I'm asking myself 20, 30, 40 times a day. And so, but that's just become an innate habit in me that I really want to actively figure out what I need to do with my own mindset.
How do you do that in a way that isn't paralyzing? That all sounds healthy to a point, but also asking yourself that 20 to 30 times a day sounds exhausting and possibly paralyzing.
Sure. I would agree that it is. I agree that I think it's because to me, it's still fresh. You know, 4 years away sounds like a long time, but for me, all of this is still fresh. You know, I've been out for a few months now, and I'm still highly aware of how kind of the reality of my actions have played out. And I've now kind of entered back into the world realizing that I have so much more work to do. And as scary as that is, it's also a motivating feeling. I personally feel like, yes, it can be exhausting, constantly analyzing your every step. you know, and it can be mentally draining to be kind of self-checking yourself. But for me, I think that's important because I feel like I'm still growing. I'm still learning. I still have a lot of work to do. And as long as I'm open to that, I feel like I'm going to be able to kind of forge down that path that I want to. And I'm going to be able to be that role model dad that I want to be for my children and be that husband that I need to be and be that contributing, you know, member to society that I need to be. Because ultimately, we can have a grandiose vision for all the things that we want to achieve. But ultimately, if our mindset doesn't stay humble, if our mindset doesn't stay clear, and we don't remain honest to ourselves, then any of that progress we think we're making is kind of just this false presumption of what's actually happening. That there's so much more beyond the surface of what you want to achieve than just the achievement itself. It's your mindset behind it. It's the way you view it. It's your perspective. It's your emotional balance. All of these work together. And for me, being so new and being freshly out, it's still fresh. And I'm still actively, you know, doing it and trying to learn more about myself of how I can acclimate and at the same time adapt so that I can use all of these lessons in a positive way for my future.
What do you want to do or what are you doing?
Right now, I'm working with an incredible company called BuildFire. They're a startup based out of San Diego. And they're a mobile app development company that you could equate them to the Shopify or Wix of mobile apps, right? And they're an incredible company that's given me an opportunity to, you know, join their business development team. And I couldn't feel luckier. I feel so incredibly blessed.
Did you know somebody? How did you get that job out of prison?
No, I just applied. And when I applied, they had the first phone interview. And it was in the first phone interview, I think it might have been 90 seconds into the conversation where I brought up my background.
How did you do it? Did you say just BTW, I just got out of prison? How do you even introduce that?
Again, you know, that's a tough thing to address. And for me, I felt this compelling thought that, listen, as a felon, everyone already has every reason in the world not to trust us. And particularly with my specific crime, even more so the case. So I felt it an obligation and duty to bring that up out in the open. That ultimately that I want any employer that hires me to know the full story, to know the full, have a full understanding of A, where I've been, B, what I've done, and C, where I'm going. And when I brought that up in the interview, I said, I literally just kind of told the story about myself, about what happened. And the interview, you know, phone interview lasted about, you know, an hour. And they still called me in for an interview. And so I just recently joined the team. It's an incredible feeling. They're such a vibrant, exciting team. The leadership is just incredibly visionary, and the company is going to do some amazing things. We're just on the verge of scaling. And I'm so blessed to be part of that effort. I had no idea I'd be in such a fortunate position to be able to do that.
What you just described is probably the most extreme example of this. People are concerned about how their failures can follow them around and how they can present themselves afterwards. And the point that I always want people to really appreciate, which I think is what you have clearly internalized, is that you are the teller of your own story. Like, you know, if you don't tell your own story, the story may be told for you, right? In your case, somebody could have Googled you and found all this information out about you, but you can tell your own story. And if you tell it right, then whatever it is that has happened to you can be put into a context in which people can appreciate who you are because of and despite it at the same time. And that you shouldn't be afraid of your past. You should be so open to embracing it that you're able to fully own it. And that you brought up that you were in prison 90 seconds into a job interview and got the job, I think speaks a lot to, first of all, that it's important to be able to do that, to really own your story. But two, that how much owning the story and really being able to understand the story can be powerful.
I could not agree more. I mean, then again, just like you said, mine being the more extreme example, I feel like when it comes to kind of telling your own story, authenticity is number one. And I think if you look at job interviews, for instance, the process of job interviewing, how unauthentic is the job interview process, right? Everyone is putting their best self forward, is putting the most impressive things on their resume, is trying to look their best, and that's the best they're ever going to look, right? And so all of these things play into a job interview and making it a very unauthentic process. And that was something that when I came out, and I was thinking about, hey, listen, you know, you're going out and you're going to try to get a job, Neil, and you're starting over. I realized that I needed to be authentic, and the only way to be authentic is to tell exactly what happened. Because if there's any thought of sugarcoating, well, then you just fall into the same category as every other candidate that's applying for a job, where they sugarcoat their own skill sets, or you have given the employer even more reason not to trust you because you are already a felon and you already went to prison for a crime of dishonesty, and here you are doing it again. So for me, there's a yes, it's about controlling the story, and yes, it's about controlling the narrative, and the only person that's going to do that is you. But at the same time, there's an authenticity to what needs to be said as well, because I myself, based on my past experiences and past crime, I was effectively a self-promoter in which I showcased every possible quality of mine. And here, I'm trying to make a stark contrast to that. I'm trying to expose everything there is to know. I want the employer or anybody who knows me, any relationship I start, any friend I meet, to know the worst of me as they get started in this relationship. Because then in that situation, it can only get better from there. If the employer or the friend or the new relationship or colleague can take you for what you are, that is the start of high quality relationships. And ultimately, I think that, you know, that's what the job process is too. And I feel extremely fortunate that they gave me that chance.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask you as a kind of final question here, but you almost answered it. So I just want you to elaborate. I mean, I was wondering how much you were prepared to, or how much you even wanted for this experience to define you, or to be something that you're going to be talking about or drawing from for the rest of your life. I mean, you know, you a decision you could have made was to try to take that impact program, for example, and then just do it forever, right? It'd be the scared straight guy who just walks into different organizations and talks about your failure. And you're not necessarily doing that, but what you did just articulate was a version of it, a kind of more distributed version of it, in which what you're saying, and I just want to make sure I understand it, what you're saying is that you're very prepared for this to be something that's a part of you. Maybe it doesn't follow you because you're not trying to run away from it, but just as that is a part of you forever. Is that right?
100% accurate. This is a part of me forever. And as I look back and I think about how could I have done that? How could I have done these things to affect these people and affect negatively affect every facet of my life? I still have to realize that this is what it is. This is who I am. This is what my past is. And I have to embrace that. I'm not going to lie, though, at the same time, I do have an overwhelming sense of guilt that is still present. And I do have periods of shame where I've assigned that guilt to the value of who I am. And that I don't think that'll go away either. In fact, that feeling is better redirected into a motivating source. But in terms of kind of guiding for the future, as much as I'm starting with this amazing company, you know, I still have the vision to do other projects that do relate to my background. For instance, just like the Impact Program, I want to start a similar program that unites people with similar backgrounds in terms of having gone to prison that goes out and speaks publicly to high schools and junior highs and probationary centers, very much like we did on the inside. Because I believe that there is a need for that. There is a need for people to share more experiences about what it's like on the inside and what led them down that path to educate young audiences that may be misguided or don't have that guidance. And so I do believe that's an important thing. And at the same time, I have this desire to actually go, you know, meet and collaborate with professional schools, you know, law schools, business schools, colleges, about what it means to the fact that every single individual in their life is going to be, you know, arriving at a point where they have this fork in the road, just like I did. That every single day in one's career, they could be tested morally or ethically and what it means to take the wrong turn. You know, I feel like nobody's speaking about that right now. Nobody is sharing those stories where it could provide an insight on what happens if they make that wrong choice. And I feel like that's something that I want to do. So yes, it's kind of carrying my past and bringing it into the future in some element. And I'll be, you know, I hope to start a project that devotes energy towards that. And at the same time, secondarily, I hope to join an organization called Defy Ventures. Defy Ventures is an amazing organization that helps those coming out of prison become entrepreneurs. And they have a local chapter here in San Diego, and I hope to get involved from a volunteer perspective, because I feel like there's so many good people that go to prison. There's so many people that have talents or skill sets that can be redirected in something positive. And if you look at the current recidivism rate, whether it's 77% of people that go to prison end up going back to prison within 5 years. And why is that? It's a lack of education. It's a lack of understanding of what their true skill set is and what their potential is. And Defy Ventures is an amazing organization that's doing that. And I hope to participate as a volunteer that helps mentor other entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs that are coming out of prison, that are hoping to kind of turn around their life. And I hope I can play, you know, a role in that.
Neil, thank you so much for reaching out and being so extremely open. And I'm excited for your future.
Jason, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, you know, being in touch with you over the past couple of years. And I consider myself eternally blessed and so grateful to have this opportunity. I appreciate it.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feifer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.